Welcome to Chatter on Books. I'm your announcer, Jamie McIntyre. We attempted to come up with a creative introduction to the show, but our writers are on strike. Here's Tori Clark.
Good, we're back. Welcome to Chatter on Books. We are happily coming to you from East City Bookshop at 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, correct? It's a really beautiful evening out. If you're out tonight walking, strolling with the dogs, come on by. Nah, it's pouring down rain. It's awful. Joining us, Michael Kornheiser, David Aldrich, Claude doing all the important things. Kate here at East City doing the other really important things, like pouring the wine. We've got lots of fun things on tap for this evening, and I'm going to make this a really fast show, because if I don't leave in time to get to the airport to meet Brian,
At 6:58?
No, we're leaving at about 10. Dulles, I should be able to get there, right?
Oh, you're going out?
We're flying
tonight?
Out.
Have
yeah,
you
leaving
seen
tonight.
The traffic on 66?
I saw it starting at 3 o'clock this afternoon, yeah.
No, it's going to be better. It's gonna be so
I'll be phoning
better.
In this
I get
show.
There 45 minutes before an international flight.
Oh, I didn't know you were leaving like now.
Yeah, now. Passport's in the purse, ready
right,
to go.
Ready to
suitcase in the car.
You have global entry, right?
Yes, but did you hear about if you're from New York?
Yes, and DC's on the list too.
No, oh, if you already have it, you're good though?
I think so, but still, 13 cities and 13 states in the district that they're targeting.
I'll never fly again if I don't have global entry.
I missed this.
Ever.
I'll explain later.
It's terrible. It's terrible. We tend to stay away from the source of that conversation. We've got a couple of emails. Michael's going to roll out a new segment. It's more than a segment that we're going to try. We've got with us Lori.
We're going to class.
Yeah.
All right.
You were at school today. You're warmed up. We've got with us Lori Gilman, the owner of East City Bookshop. Talk about what's happening with you local independent hotshots. People have been leaving this room to go buy books, which is a really good thing.
Yes.
Okay, Michael was. Our featured author, Jeffrey Rosen, who is a really, really interesting guy on his way in from the metro as we speak. And Legal Beagle, author, historian, writer, commentator, all sorts of things, and has a remarkable friendship with RBG, the notorious RBG. Mm-hmm. And he has this wonderful book, which is Conversations with RBG, and it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg on life, love, liberty, and law. I've always been amazed by this woman, and even more amazed now, seeing the kinds of things he got her to talk about. Mm-hmm. The law not being the least of it, but certainly not the most important part of those conversations. And Deserted Island is going to be Black History Month books. And I've got a really good one.
Or as I refer to them, books.
Books.
Right. Just books.
Awesome. Awesome. But first, Calvert Woodley Wine and Cheese. I was there yesterday on a Sunday. Calvert Woodley is never not busy.
Always
busy.
Yeah, those are great.
Location.
Well, true, but they're
and
also
staff. Really knowledgeable staff. So they gave us, well, I kind of picked myself, the wine of the evening. It's called Studio by Miraval. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's one of the drier rosés. Comes from some plots on the French Riviera. Most interestingly, I was talking to some of the team here earlier, the vineyard is owned by Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. And you say to yourself, I know they're not married anymore. They're still in together on the vineyard.
Okay.
They bought a vineyard. It's where they got married way back when. And this particular vineyard was famous for being a vineyard. And then whoever owned it before them turned it into a studio where a lot of famous musical groups would record records and things like that. So in tribute to them, they call it Studio by Miraval. What do we think, Claude? Thumbs up.
Very nice.
David?
Very nice.
Hard to get the, you know, correct tasting notes when I'm drinking it out of a mug.
Yeah. Well, we just thought we'd be a little more discreet than our usual.
Okay.
And then Ibrahim was working on Sunday, which was a nice surprise. Blue Castello from Denmark, cow's milk, similar to Brie.
Did not get the cheese.
You need to try
it's
this
good.
Cheese.
All right. It's good. They say it's good for the blue cheese newbies. So if you're not a big blue cheese fan or you're not, then you have this. It's pretty good. Okay. Couple of randoms, couple of emails. Michael, one is definitely for you.
Uh-oh.
So remember you said that one of your New Year's resolutions, you wanted to read more nonfiction?
Correct.
Okay, this is from Mark Hannum. Message from Michael K. Listen to the Susan Page podcast. I heard him say that he's looking to read more nonfiction books this year. A great book is The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown. It's a great story of what life in the United States was like in the early 20th century. This is a fabulous book. Mm. Have you read it, Lori? It's fabulous. If you like things like Seabiscuit,
I've heard of this.
Unbroken. Yes. Both by Laura and Hillenbrand.
Correct.
Which are just remarkable stories of remarkable people in and of themselves, but also tells you about a time in history. The Boys in the Boat is fabulous.
I think your future husband, Steve Kerr, recommended this book to me.
No.
Yes, I think so.
You guys are talking about books and I'm not part of the conversation?
I think
Crushed
he, yes,
again.
We were talking, yeah, I think he said that it's an amazing book, yes.
It's an amazing book, and I can see where somebody who is a coach and trying to get a lot of people to play and work together, mm-hmm. because that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
So that's a really good one, Michael. Do you think there's a snowball's chance in hell you didn't read it?
Yeah, I've Googled it, so it's in my tab to explore more.
Okay, great.
If only I were at a bookstore right now.
The bookstore might have a copy of that book. Yeah. Yes.
Have you read any nonfiction yet, Michael?
The month or the year is still early.
It is.
We're only 7 weeks in.
Almost Valentine's Day, baby.
Yeah.
It is fascinating. I want to read more fiction. Is that all I read is nonfiction?
That's what, again, my New Year's resolution was more fiction. So we're reversing. But Boys in the Boat is so good. Mm-hmm. And if I really like something, I'll read it and then I listen to it. Mm. And I can't remember who did the voice, but whoever did the voice was spectacular.
Interesting. Why do you go that direction, reading then listening?
I have no idea. Maybe because it's on Amazon, hardcover copy drops down first, or I'm at a bookstore.
Going the opposite way and wanting to savor the words on the page after having fallen in love with the story or the direction.
If I fall in love, I'm in love.
Can I take this moment to plug Libro FM?
Yes, go ahead, explain that. I was reading about that on the wall upstairs, but explain it.
It is the independent bookstore version, or I guess gateway to audiobooks.
Okay.
And it is an excellent, excellent company. It is as good and easy to use as Audible, which, as you all know, is owned by Amazon. Mm-hmm. So we are happy to have an alternative that supports local bookstores that is really, really good and easy to use.
Bezos is really having a tough time of it right now.
Oh, yeah. It's rough. It's rough.
So you get a piece of it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So when you purchase it through our website, we get a percentage of that sale. And
done.
Great. Yeah. Well, and so, you know, I find one great thing to do is I end up reading and listening to audiobooks. If I'm really trying to get through something, I'm, you know, cooking dinner, listening, and in bed and read, and really can
give me
really
the name
smash
of that
through
audiobooks.
Some books that way.
Yeah. I find it calms me down. Listening to them makes me slow down. Mm-hmm. Michael, you're looking for something.
No, I'm trying. It's Libro FM, right?
Yeah. Libro.fm.
Okay. I'm trying to remember where I was recommended this service. FM. Would it be through a library as well, or is that something different?
No, that's different.
Okay.
I can't remember what
theirs
are
called. Maybe
there's
another independent bookstore.
I mean, there is a library one, but then you know, it's like you're checking out that.
No, Tori, this is my thinking face as I'm trying to go back over the last year, and I'm reminded that I haven't read any nonfiction.
Libby is the library.
There you go. Libby, does that sound familiar?
Maybe.
Libby.
Okay, you look that up. Well, I'll read the next email. This is from Todd Totten, and very nice, says nice things about the podcast and loves everybody. But most importantly, I talked to Michael about this the other day. He says, I used to work in a Walden Books in an actual shopping mall during college. Now I'm 50. God bless you, child. Bookstores used to throw all of the books away that took up too much shelf room. To get credit for the unsold books, the proofs had to be sent back to the publishers. We'd be sent to the dumpster the night before trash pickup to tear the covers off hundreds of books. We'd keep the covers and throw away the rest of the paper. Hardcore and budget readers would ask us to hide a few of the ones they couldn't afford to buy so they didn't have to dumpster dive to get them. Who knew? Who knew people were dumpster diving for books?
Book diving.
Yeah. I filled lots of bags with topless books. I hope the small bookstores aren't still ripping and tossing the unsold books. Lori, are the small bookstores?
That is probably not most independent bookstores. That's something that happens with mass market paperbacks, which we don't carry a lot of. That's like the smaller trim size that's, you know, less expensive.
Easier
paper.
To do.
So that's why they just say trash them instead.
There's Jeffrey Rosen. Hi, Jeffrey Rosen. Mm-hmm. Come take a seat.
Please
if you can find one. Okay. I hope the small bookstores aren't still ripping and tossing the unused books. If they are, I hope they're still hiding a few books without covers for those who can't afford to just decorate their guest rooms with books. That was a snide comment about some of our listeners.
Sounds like they've seen my guest
Todd,
room.
Todd, yeah. Ever see, and then he goes on, new paragraph, ever see those little library boxes outside schools or other public areas? Yes, we have one in Somerset. When I see them, I pick a book and hide a $20 bill in the book with a note on cardstock.
Hello?
signs it, "Thanks for reading."
Nice.
S. King or G. Clooney or B. Obama. Is that wrong?
No.
No, that is not wrong at all. That's it's a great idea.
I'm embarrassed to say we pass by so many of these little bookstops, and I've always wanted, because I have so many extra books, particularly YA books, that I'm never going to go back and read again. And I never make the step to leave them.
Mm-hmm. I've left a few books in there. Yeah. And then this he says, cheers, keep drinking and chattering. So Todd, thank you very much. There we go. Okay. So Lori, tell us what's going on. What's going on here at East City Bookshop at 645 Pennsylvania?
Other than rain, lots of rain.
It does impact the business, right?
It does. Rain more than
anything. You are a neighborhood bookstore.
Even on a night like
that. I mean, we do, but nothing like we would normally
have. Because I think people want to get rid of the, you know, doldrums of a rainy day by walking to the bookstore.
Not if they have to go out and get soapy.
I mean, you know, we have had people coming in all day, but on a night with an event, we would normally have, you know, a lot of people coming into the shop, and it's just kind of a little bit quiet. But we had a very busy holiday season, which was great. And we've been really busy over last January. January was really great guns, and February starting,
which isn't true for most retail, right? January,
right?
Not.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not
New Year's resolutions to read more nonfiction,
right? Yeah. I think, and you know, winter curling up with a good book, that's always good. It's not like it's, you know, the busiest month, but it's not terrible.
That's good. Yeah. What's selling? What's hot?
We have one book that I want to plug because I loved it.
And go for
it. Also, one of our best sellers for the last month or so is called Long Bright River by Liz Moore.
Long Bright River. That sounds
Long
right.
Bright River. Write that down. You can buy one here. We actually had an event with the author, Liz Moore, and it is set in Philadelphia. And it was interesting because it's kind of a mystery. It's like it's been put into mystery genre, but it's really a very literary book. So it's a little bit in two categories. It tells the story of two sisters. One is a police officer. One is addicted to opioids in the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia. And it tells this kind of story of a murder along with their relationship. It's so well done. It's really gorgeous.
Okay. And people are buying it, or you're just pushing it?
I'm buying it.
What's
that?
People are buying it, or you're just pushing it?
Oh, yeah. We've sold them. That's probably our number one seller since the first of the year.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we ask you about American Dirt?
Oh. Goodness. Yes, of course you can. We were actually at a book conference. This is a national conference called Winter Institute that happens every winter, and booksellers from all over the country gather for meeting authors and publishers.
Where'd you gather?
We gathered this year in Baltimore.
Ooh.
So for us, it was very handy, but not exciting. Right. Last year, we were in Albuquerque. They try to move it around the country so that it's not too far for, you know, somebody all the time. And so it came out while we were there, and this had started the whole idea of it really being a marketing issue more than a lot of things. I mean, I read it close to a year ago probably, and enjoyed it. You know, it was very fast-paced. It's well-written, so I would argue with some people who said it was not at all well-written. It was. It really kind of moved. I felt a lot of empathy for the characters, but everybody who's had problems with it about own voices and authors not getting representation is right. Mm-hmm. So it was really, I mean, it was a huge, clearly their big title, and it was a huge marketing push, and as you saw.
And it's still doing well, right?
It's selling.
Yeah, I was talking to your team beforehand. It's number one, I think, on... at least in New York Times.
We haven't. I mean, it's not up in our top sellers, but we did make a decision to sell it, but not to really push it with additional marketing and things because I don't really want to be the person saying, "Oh no, I don't think you should. I don't think you should buy that book." I mean, I'm sure there are books out there I would do that for, but not this book. But we also took it as an opportunity to highlight lots of Latinx authors.
The own voices section
own
up
voices
there, yeah.
Section, yeah. And so it was a good discussion, but it really was a lot of, you know, it's hard when when you really love books and yeah. authors and you know what goes into that and you kind of know how the whole thing works around it. And this one was like this perfect storm of things that need to be changed yeah. and missteps. Yeah. And yeah, it's been very interesting.
And you wonder, Michael, I want to ask you about teaching something like that in a school, but you also wonder how much thought you seldom see as much pre-buzz as you saw in this book. And right. John Grishams and Stephen Kings of the world don't do blurbs. They right. very, very rarely do blurbs. Right. And then I can't remember who was it that compared it to Grapes of Wrath.
Oh,
so you're hearing all stuff. And before all the craziness started, I read it thinking, okay, I like it. And I honestly, and I'm reading it going, this would be a great Netflix series. Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. A great Netflix series. I don't know if I loved it as a book, but I just kept saying, good story, exciting, these kinds of things.
Right. Like,
great characters in the book.
Right.
Yeah. But then what it turned into, yes. it did raise some really, really important issues mm-hmm. about opportunities for some people to get books published. It was very difficult. But wow, the craziness out
yeah.
there was pretty insane. Would a book this new and a book involved in something like this, Michael, ever get taught in a DMB high school?
I think it would. I think it's hard to imagine what type of school would allow that to happen because you have to give a lot of ownership to the individual teacher. And I think even when we were at this bookstore earlier, we talked about sort of curriculum design and department level design as to how you want to structure the progression, say, through 9th through 12th grade. Something like this, I could see this being part of an upper class elective. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't necessarily be part of your day-to-day or week-to-week. It might be like, we want to take a look at, we always study books as these vessels of history. It's a timestamp novel that's the same book that when your parents were in high school and they probably read it as well. Sometimes it's interesting to pull the cloak back and say, let's look at something that's now. Maybe this doesn't have, say, the same weight for some readers, but it's important to talk about mm-hmm. in the here and now, particularly if you want to bring in the angle of privilege as to how do some books get the green light, how do others not?
Yeah.
What are the choices that we all make as to what we're going to teach due to influence those, say, future generations of readers? So I would say as an add-on, I could definitely see how I could put that into a class, but it would be a pretty, you would have to have a pretty good group of students who understood where that value is the add-on, not necessarily part of
right.
my 45-minute block of homework yeah. on a Tuesday.
And Lori, did people at your conference, did people talk about things like that? You know, why?
Oh, yes.
Because
yes.
other people have told very similar stories
yes.
that Jeanine Cummings told. So did you all talk about that?
Well, there were, I think at a bookseller conference, it was more about publishing and sort of how that kind of thing can come about and uh-huh. how other voices... What's the route to have other voices heard? Because uh-huh. it is a very, very white industry,
yeah.
very very affluent. It's hard to get a publishing job if you don't have some other, or hard to live on a salary of a yeah. lot of publishing mm-hmm. jobs. So I was really hoping it would result in some large portion of money going to, you know, internships and things within sure. publishing companies
sure. Sure.
who have a different outlook and a different background. But
yeah.
I think hopefully it will eventually end up that way.
Raise some consciousness.
Right.
So what are you most excited about coming up when it stops raining? What are you most excited about coming up at East City Bookshop?
When it stops raining. I know. Then it's not as,
well, someday.
As good as it's good reading weather. That's one thing. Well, we are very excited about this is, I guess, could be connected to Black History Month also, or as we call it, March February. Is another month. Just a month, because we like to read all books all the time. But we are having an event, actually, with Jason Reynolds and Dr. Ibram Kendi.
Ah,
both or, very hard to get. Not yes. that I haven't tried.
Yes.
Very hard to get.
Said hello.
Yes. I will.
My fellow American University guy.
Yes, yes. And so we are very excited to be hosting
awesome.
Their launch for the version of the young adult version of Stamped. And
okay.
it is
yeah.
phenomenal.
That's great.
Jason worked with Ibram on it. And
when are you doing
really
it?
Really nailed this. It is March 8th.
March 8th. Okay.
Yes.
That'll
March
be a great
8th,
event.
We're going to have it at the Capitol Hill United Methodist Church right
nice.
Near Eastern Market Metro. So
very nice.
Easy to get to, and you can get tickets on our website.
Okay, great. Yep. Well, thank you. Again, thank you for letting us be here. We love coming here.
Awesome.
Stay with us.
I am buying that book when we're done about the Philadelphia.
Well, it doesn't come out until.
It doesn't. I'll pre-order it.
If you come to the event, you will get it before it, the actual publication date, two days early.
All right. You are making money with this show, Lori. Okay, stay here for a minute because Michael's going to talk about a new, it's not a segment. What are we calling it, Michael?
I just think it'd be a fun activity. So,
Lori could give us some advice because they host book clubs here.
One of the reasons you wanted to start this show was you wanted to have a place where we could talk about books, but it wasn't necessarily your local neighborhood book club. And now I have this crazy idea that's sort of going back to the roots of that question, which is, why don't we all read a book together? We make recommendations, we talk about books. And I was viewing this from the lens of a teacher saying it'd be fun for me to try and take you behind what it means to lesson plan, to try and figure out how we want to chunk different, say, blocks of the reading, how we want to break that down, what sort of activities we might use. And some of it could just be the hypothetical, which could just, you know, here's an opening activity I might use. Mm-hmm. How would this go over with you? Would you even try this? So it could be offering resources to us and then by extension, the audience that they could take some, leave the others. It could include some simple activities like a read aloud where Tori reads a 2-page chapter and in real time is giving her, you know, her actual thoughts going. I always use the phrase, you know, when you read, you're moving forwards and backwards. You're making hypotheses. You're testing past hypotheses. Mm-hmm. You're making predictions.
Right.
And that's a skill that, you know, good readers actively do if you try and take a look at someone's annotation. So
I'm already being graded. This is bringing, bad memories.
But I don't want it to be that way. And if that's what you feel, then
St. James.
You know, get out the ruler. but I would try and choose or have us choose books that are not super long, that are not super dense. I'd like them to be part of the pop culture of what's current, but not necessarily today's hottest bestseller. It could be a couple years old. So you actually went back and this was a book that we had been discussing probably a month or so ago. And you brought up a really timely
book. Go ahead. Which book is it?
This was Station 11.
Lori loves it. This is good.
John Mandel. And essentially what happens is you have a well-known actor who passes away right at the onset of a pandemic, a flu that takes over the world. And you reset to year zero. And it focuses on an actor who has been given a graphic novel, something from this well-known actor. And she travels with it with this group of actors who are playing Shakespeare, and they're doing this by memory. You're pulling up different bits and parts that you remember. Mm-hmm. And it's about the trials of trying to find community in this new world. That's probably oversimplifying it because I haven't read it in a couple of years, but I feel like that would be fun by just the conversations we're all having right now.
I think it's great. Sure. Lori, what do you think? Good one for our virtual book club?
That's a good one. Yeah.
Okay. So we're all going to order it and read it. And what's step one, Michael?
I'll come up with step one for our next episode. Let me reread and then I can give you.
Yeah.
So if this were a classroom, we would try and go into background knowledge. So I'd try and say, what are some of the Shakespearean plays that you remember? What are some of your issues with Shakespeare? And we'd start with King Lear. I mean, I know you have experience.
Personal attraction to that, yes.
So, but that could be an interesting way as you're trying to get into this, and then we could go from there. Because I don't want this to just be, you know, reader response of this book makes me feel like I finally have a community that I can join on the road. I think it'd be fun. We all like going back to the feeling of going back to school for a rewarding experience. Or we don't have to write the paper.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
That's the good part.
No more book reports. That didn't go well. We only got 2 out of 4, right? David's made people cry. That you made people cry.
No, I didn't make anybody
you
cry.
Did. Yeah.
And then
somebody gave you credit for mine, and that crushed me.
Interesting classic high school boy move. I somehow was assigned one. I created this assignment, that I never finished.
Exactly. Oops. There's still time. Okay, Lori, I'm guessing you don't have Station 11 here, but we could order it at East City.
It's still a really good seller, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But if we don't, yes, you can order it.
Here's what's embarrassing. I still have the hard copy on my wall of, you know.
There's nothing embarrassing about that. That's wonderful.
Your emailer might call my wall of fame. I got the hard cover up.
Nice. No, your guest bedroom.
I have to say that Emily St. John Mandel has a new book coming out this spring. It's called The Glass Hotel.
Oh, this will be great.
Unfortunately, mm-hmm. I can't read more fiction.
Being weaned off of it.
We'll read it for you. This is not your mother's book club. Yeah, this is not your mother's book club, and we read so you don't have to. Yeah. So we can do that. Yeah. Lori, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. We're going to swap you out with Jeff Rosen, our author of the evening.
This is Chatter on Books, because everyone should have a podcast.
We're back. It's Chatter on Books. We're at East City Books, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast. And even though it's pouring down rain, you should come to this wonderful bookstore where, again, it's a little bit like Calvert Woodley, very knowledgeable staff. There's not much they haven't heard about. There's not much they don't know. They are really, Lori Gilman and team working really well with the greater DMV community. And we are very, speaking of, we're very happy to be joined by author, teacher, legal beagle, expert, head of the National Constitution Center. There's not enough time in this show, Jeff, to talk about all your things. And creator of the wonderful Conversations with RBG. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
It's very nice of you. Great to have you here. So we've had, Jeff, we've had several authors on who we asked them their backstory. You know, where'd you come from? What did you want to be when you're five? We've had several, right, guys, who were lawyers or wanted to be lawyers and gave it up and became writers. So when you were 5, 6, 7 years old, what did you want to be? Astronaut. A lot of them wanted to be astronauts.
You know, when I was 5, 6, or 7, oddly, I wanted to be Pope.
There you go.
Which is an unexpected ambition
very
for a good Jewish boy from New York. I really don't know where it came from.
A little bit.
Happily, it didn't go very far. You know, I made a good run at it.
Well, it was before there were two of them.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah,
I am throwing out all my questions because this is great. Would you like the hat? What was it?
I think it was the hat and the music and the tradition. And there must have been something about literature and history because that was what I really loved. And that, in the end, is what I ended up doing.
I love the ritual.
Yeah.
How did your parents
share their faith, but I love
Yeah,
ritual.
How did your parents break the news to you?
You know, gently, really.
We had Pete Souza on, an amazing, interesting guy, and one of the greatest photographs in his book, Shade, is of a Halloween party at the White House. And a little kid has pulled up in their Michelle Obama, and a little kid has pulled up in a Pope mobile. And they had completely tricked out his little push cart to look like the Pope Mobile. Mm-hmm. And he was wearing the most spectacular vestments. That's what they were called, right? Mm-hmm. And the hat and the little red leather shoes.
Beautiful.
Spectacular. See,
maybe there's hope for him. He can carry on the Rosen name.
Good. Tell us briefly about the National Constitution Center, because it's pretty amazing, and the interactive Constitution.
It is so amazing and so exciting. So for folks who haven't been there, it's this beautiful temple to the Constitution on Independence Mall, right across from Independence Hall, with the rarest copies of the Constitution, its very earliest drafts, early copies of the Bill of Rights, live theater about the Constitution and the 14th Amendment, an exhibit about the Civil War. And it's just the most inspiring place for learners of all ages to experience the Constitution. But then it's this amazing online learning platform that anyone who's listening has got to go to right now and check it out, or wait till after the show. First listen about RBG,
and then go
to the interactive Constitution.
Review it kindly. Yeah.
And it unites the best liberal and conservative legal scholars in the country to write about every clause of the Constitution, describing what they agree about and what they disagree about. It has videos with Justices Gorsuch and Kagan and all sorts of folks. It has this tool, the drafting table, which Chief Justice Roberts gave a shout out in his year-end report on the judiciary. He called it this marvelous tool that allows you to explore early drafts of every part of the Constitution. And maybe coolest of all, well, there's more, I'm like a Ginsu knife salesman, it has this great podcast I do every week where I call up a liberal and a conservative to talk about constitutional issues in the news. And then it has all our public programs and videos. It's got this tool called Constitutional Exchanges. And I was so psyched that you're a teacher and want to learn about ways that we might connect. But we're uniting tens of thousands of classrooms across the country for live discussions about the Constitution moderated by judges or master teachers. And it's free and online. Any classroom can sign up using this great material. It teaches you the tools of civil dialogue as well as learning about different parts of the Constitution. We really think it's going to transform civil dialogue in America.
And millions of people have already gone there, right? Millions of people have already gone to the site and used the interactive nature of what you're offering, right?
So the interactive Constitution has gotten 30 million hits since it launched just 5 years ago. That's how hungry people are for information about the Constitution. If you Google the First or Second Amendment, we come up second or third generally right now. And as a result, The National Constitution Center is the fifth most visited museum website in America and the seventh most in the world, all because of hits to the Constitution, which have so dramatically escalated in recent years.
It's fabulous. Michael, was that there when you were at Penn? No.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just started.
Yeah, I used to work for Comcast, so I've been there, and it is absolutely beautiful. The location is spectacular, and everything you said, plus more. People should go and check it out immediately.
Absolutely.
Okay, again, so many things we could talk about, but really want to talk about this great book, Conversations with RBG. And this really got started, Jeff, tell me if I'm wrong, because of a mutual love of opera? Because one of the reasons this is so great, I think, is because of your friendship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And that started over opera?
It did. And it was an unexpected bond. We met in an elevator. And I was a young law clerk. It's 1991 on the U.S. Court of Appeals, right a few metro stops from here. I was going up on the elevator to get some documents. She was coming down from an exercise class called Jazzercise, because it's the 90s, and you remember Jazzercise. And we're sitting on...
Jane Fonda was teaching
it. Leg warmers.
Yes, it was very... I think there might have been... There was some workout gear involved, because she's very serious about this, as you know. But she was completely silent, and she was maintaining this sphinx-like opacity, which those who don't know her can mistake for inaccessibility. And I just had to break the ice. I had to think of something to say. Unfortunately, I'm hopeless about sports. I can't even fake it. So I just blurted out, what operas have you seen recently? And I didn't even know she was an opera fan, but I am. And that's what I wanted to talk about. And it was the $60,000 question. It was the right thing to ask. And she just blossomed. She opened up and we started excitingly talking about what she had seen and what she was going to see and her favorite shows. And that conversation continued throughout the year and over the past 25 years.
What made you an opera fan?
Gosh, I just listened to so much when I was a kid. It started with Gilbert and Sullivan, I'm embarrassed to share.
It's a good break-in.
It's a gateway drug to opera.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Then I went to, I grew up in New York City, and we'd go either standing room at the Met or sometimes second act. You know, you could get people to give you tickets. And it was just such a thrill to see those shows live. Mm-hmm. And I just, something in it resonated so deeply with me, as it does with her. And I find myself, as I get older, experiencing it as a kind of spiritual connection, something that gets you outside of yourself. And I asked Justice Ginsburg, how do you experience opera? Does it get you outside of yourself? And she said, yes, opera is wonderful for that. When I'm listening to music, I can't think of the opinion I have to write or the brief I have to read. I just get completely lost in the music.
It's beautiful. Absolutely. Okay, so in Washington, you know, somebody tells a story and you have to immediately make it about yourself.
Absolutely.
So I grew up in Pittsburgh, and my parents, God bless them, raising five girls, King Lear.
Did you have to divvy up the estate?
It's a work in progress.
This is closer than we thought.
Still looking for that co-author.
Absolutely.
They loved opera, and they wanted to introduce us to opera, and so they would get season tickets to the opera. I would have to scrounge with my friends to get season tickets to the Pirates and the Steelers, but they got season tickets to the opera. But this was when I was very young, and the opera didn't start till 7:30 or 8 or something like that. So we would go into Pittsburgh, and we'd go have dinner somewhere, and I'm usually an Italian restaurant or something like that, and then we'd go to the opera, and 20 minutes in, I would fall asleep. So for years, I could tell you the first 10, 15 minutes of every opera under the sun, but never the rest of it. So this starts this beautiful relationship, and there are so many things, and you guys chime in, there's so many things we could ask you about. Let's go from the most general to the most specific. She is very different than any other Supreme Court justice. Like, just so different. What is it that makes her, so there are plenty of smart people, there are plenty of people who really understand the law, who really appreciate the Constitution, but what is it that has made her so different?
It's such an important question, because you're right, this is the first icon, the first rock star the Supreme Court has ever had, but she is also the greatest woman I've ever met. One of the most important...
Other than your wife.
Lauren is not great. Lauren is spectacular.
Ouch.
Lauren is beloved. Lauren
Tough
is
Valentine's Day.
No, not at all. What I'm saying is, as a historical figure, this is one of the most important women for constitutional change in American history. She ranks with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Mercy Otis Warren, the greatest of crusaders for equality, and with Thurgood Marshall, Frederick Douglass. This is a towering historical figure based on her advocacy alone. But that's just the beginning of her greatness. Then she's what we all know, the notorious RBG, the fiery leader of the liberal opposition, who's galvanized young women and women of all ages and men of all ages because of the power of her dissents, the fact that she breaks stereotypes. Many young women say the woman who started that notorious RBG blog, you know, a woman in her 80s is not supposed to be this strong, this powerful, but here she is expressing herself with such fervor. But there's more, and what I really hope that people take away from this book is the greatness of her character as an example of how to live. She is the most focused, self-disciplined, and at the same time empathetic human being I've ever had the privilege of meeting. And there are so many examples of that in the book, but her astonishing attention to detail, the fierceness with which she enforces deadlines and corrects typos. I talked about the amazing experience.
A look of pain just went across Jeff's face.
No, well, I'm not that accurate a typist, but I sent her the manuscript of the book last year, and then she became ill. As we all know, she had cancer surgery, and I didn't want to bother her, and I was praying for her. I didn't think that anything would happen on the project. 10 minutes after the Supreme Court term ended last June, I got an email from her saying the manuscript is ready and I'll give it to you on Tuesday. And I showed up in her chambers and she handed me the manuscript, and every page was marked up in her beautiful pencil handwriting. Commas corrected, periods rearranged, but also individual words changed so that her meaning could be as precise as possible. And I was literally stunned. I said, how on earth did you have time to do this in the middle of all of your burdens and responsibilities? And she said, well, I told you I would get this to you, and I'd like to meet my deadlines. I said, but how did you actually do it? You have so much going on. She said, well, I was in the back of cars or in an Uber, or I would, you know, in a movie theater, I would see every minute. And I said, you know, I'm really flabbergasted. You often quote your mother saying that it's important to do two things, to be a lady and to be independent. Those were the two things her mother told her. And also to overcome unproductive emotions like anger and jealousy because they're distracting. And I said, that's the advice of the great wisdom traditions. Yes, it is, she said. But it's very hard to follow in practice. Yes, it is, she said. I said, how do you actually do it? And she said, because I realize if I don't do it, I'll lose precious time for productive work. And it's very important to just do the work. And that is so galvanizing to me. And it's so inspiring. And really, every moment of the day when I'm tempted to browse whatever, cat videos or real estate sites, you know, rather than reading deeply or learning Twitter. Or writing Twitter, of course. I think of this great woman with all of the burdens of the world on her shoulders, with so much to do, taking time to perform every task with complete focus, complete discipline, and also always thoughtfulness of others. And I asked WWRBG do, and I try to set down the Twitter and take up the book and to just do the work. And it's incredibly inspiring, and I hope that others will be inspired too.
Yeah. We're not long past the holiday season. Laureate East City Books had a great holiday season in January. But you walk through a bookstore. You walk through – there's a store in Georgetown that sells all things made in D.C. And you walk around, and there are – of course, T-shirts with her image all over it. There are puppets. There are candies, greeting cards. And it's remarkable. And she really, we just talked about Kobe Bryant transcending the sport from which he came and reaching people in lots of other areas. She transcends any boundaries whatsoever, which is remarkable.
And it's so, I mean, it's such a privilege, obviously. It's just a lucky break, a lucky blessing of my life to have happened to run into her in the elevator, but to observe the transformation, because no one who met her in 1991 could possibly have imagined this. Sure. She was a judge's judge. She was the careful judicial minimalist. Amazingly, she was opposed by some progressive groups, including some women's groups, who thought either that she was too conservative or that she'd criticize the reasoning of Roe v. Wade. She wanted to ground it on women's equality rather than privacy, which turned out to be prescient.
Let's stop there for a second. Talk about that a little bit. And I didn't know this. I know a lot of things about her. I know she reads emails during the previews and movies because she wants to get some work done, which is great. But she somewhat kiddingly would refer to herself often as a flaming feminist.
Yeah.
But she was criticized by the classic feminists, I'll call them, for what she wrote about Roe v. Wade. So can you explain that?
Yes, she had two criticisms of Roe. She published them in a lecture at NYU in 1991, right before the Supreme Court vacancy came out. And her first criticism was that Roe was too broad. It presumed to come up with a complicated set of abortion regulations for every stage of pregnancy. If the court had merely struck down the extreme Texas law at issue at that case, which had no exceptions except for the life of the mother, then, Justice Ginsburg said, the court might have avoided the political backlash which galvanized the pro-life movement, which turned every Supreme Court nomination into a referendum on abortion. And she thought that the states would have liberalized abortion regulations on their own because the political momentum was going in a liberal direction. Second, she criticized the reasoning. She said it made no sense to ground the right to choose in an amorphous right to privacy, which, first of all, doesn't appear explicitly in the Constitution, but more importantly for her, was a kind of gendered sense of the privacy of male doctors and their ability to make autonomous decisions to protect their vulnerable women patients. Instead, she said, the court should have been decided on the grounds of a woman's right to equality. Restrictions on abortion impose burdens on women that are not imposed on men and prevent women from defining their own life course and making their autonomous choices. This was an argument that, with her incredible prescience, she'd made as early as 1971 in a case called the Strzok case that became moot because it was settled. The court didn't get a chance to decide it. But then Judge Ginsburg said, if the court had been decided on grounds of equality rather than privacy, it would have firmer constitutional grounding, because the right of equality is undoubtedly in the Constitution, as well as more expansively taking account of future cases. So far from being conservative, this proved to be incredibly brilliantly prophetic and prescient. And when the court reaffirmed Roe in 1993, it embraced the equality rationale. And today, women and men, scholars and citizens alike, recognize women's equality as being a firmer grounds for the right to choose than the right to equality. It was just another example of her prescience, but she took such heat for it at the time that she almost didn't get the Supreme Court nomination.
Right. Because of that.
Because of that.
Did she mind the criticism?
Or she is so self-possessed that she would say things like, I mean, and some of the criticisms were quite harsh, and she would say that, a failure to appreciate the contributions of the first generation of feminists, was not always constructive, but she never let it rattle her because she has such a firm sense of mission and is so serene in her confidence that what she was doing would actually serve women's
equality. Maybe she should have been Pope.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that hat would give her some height.
Oh, exactly. She's tight. Magnificent.
Like 5'2", right?
A big fan of Eleanor Roosevelt's, and her mother was as well, right? And her mother wrote her a note saying, stand up tall like Eleanor Roosevelt when she was young.
She did. And there's the most incredibly moving essay that young Ruth Bader wrote at the age of 13. You can find it in her book, In Her Own Words, where she writes an essay saying that Eleanor Roosevelt's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which the UN was about to sponsor, along with the Magna Carta and the First Amendment, are among the great documents of freedom. Can you imagine a 13-year-old writing this in the most beautifully composed
I couldn't write
prose.
When I was 13.
But there was something. She came out fully formed.
Yeah.
There's something so moving to me about the image of this young girl on her mother's bed, it's in their small apartment in Brooklyn, trying to not listen to the distractions and the noises to do her work as well as she could. She would play the cello sometimes or piano to relax, and writing this essay. And I had this very meaningful interview with her in December. We put on the songs of RBG by her daughter-in-law, Patrice Michaels, which are very beautiful. And I interviewed her after. And I asked her a question, which I really was eager for the answer to. I said, you've talked about the sources of your focus and your diligence, but what about your empathy? Because you're so thoughtful of others. She sends notes. When my mom passed the year before, right when she'd have finished her own surgery, she just came up and handed me a note about how you must carry on in your work and days, thriving in the joys of being alive. Isn't that just what she would have wanted? I mean, really carefully, thoughtfully thinking of others, even in the middle of everything. I said, where's the source of that empathy? Where did that come from? And she paused for a long time. And people who interview her, all of her friends know, when you talk to her, you have to be comfortable with very long pauses.
She loves silence.
Yeah. She loves silence. Yeah. And it's like much longer than is comfortable. I could do it right now, but everyone would become really antsy because it can be
a
30-second pause. but you know that it's in the silences that she's collecting her thoughts. And I once asked her, you know, on the bench, you're right in there, but you pause in the interviews. Why is that? And she said, because I learned in law school to think before I speak. I mean, she's really collecting her thoughts. So she paused for a very long time. I said, what was the source of your empathy? And she said, you know, when I was 2, my sister died at the age of 6. And seeing the effect of her death on my parents made me sensitive to the emotions and concerns of others. It was just,
wow,
just astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's incredible. And it's really moving. And to combine that, the focus and the self-discipline with that deep, deep empathy is something I've never witnessed in any other human being.
Which comes across again and again in your conversations with RBG. We're talking to Jeff Reslin. One of the things that struck me is you would be talking with her about cases, about decisions that were decades past, but she wasn't talking about the legal aspects or some policies. She was talking about the people. So, and you asked her, I think, once about some of her favorite case or favorite decision, Weisenfeld, Frontera. These names came, she was talking about them. She was talking about these people as though she had seen them yesterday. And she did stay in the lives of some of these people, right?
It's amazing. Both the precision of her memory, like a steel trap. Never seen anything like this. This is from decades before. But also, as you say, the care she took to stay in touch with these plaintiffs. She can talk about every detail of how unfair it was that Stephen Weisenfeld, who's a widow, his wife had died, and he can't get survivor's benefits to care for his infant son, Matthew, and she challenges the law, which gives the benefits to women and not men. It's struck down, and then she describes what happens to Stephen, and she performed his second marriage, and she performed Matthew's marriage, and she watched him as he went to Columbia Law School. And then I asked about Sharon Frontiero, and she said, yes, here's what she did, and she's now retired, but I'm going to see her in August to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. I mean, these cases are not abstractions for her. It is not some intellectual game or an intellectual feast, as Robert Bork famously said. These are real people with real concerns, and she's using the precision of the law along with sweeping constitutional principles to bring them justice. It's a stunning combination.
Over the years, she's had such a public profile, and she's given lots of, and she's engaged with the public in ways, again, that most of her colleagues never have. Does she enjoy it? Does she feel it's a responsibility? It's hugely beneficial, I think.
Get tired of people asking about her health.
Well, I had the amazing experience, which I described in the book, when she invited Lauren and me to spend the weekend with her at the Glimmerglass Opera. It was like a fantasy, and we saw the operas, and just watching how people interact with her. It's not easy. I mean, there are the standing ovations, of course, wherever she goes, and people are presenting her with gifts or painting murals of her, which she has to admire, and asking about her health, or just coming up and wanting to touch her and say there are no words. And of course, you should not touch her. She is frail, and she's strong, but you know, don't touch Justice Ginsburg. But
that was your
like,
job.
She's like no, I don't know. She's like the queen that way. You don't do that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that she's. This is as you see from. This is someone who's not in it for ego-based reasons. She defines. I've been reading about the sources of Jefferson's notion of the pursuit of happiness, and it comes from the Greek idea of eudaimonia from Aristotle, which means well-being or human flourishing, mastering yourself in order to serve others. That's really what she embodies, that ideal of living a virtuous life in that way. Mm-hmm. So she's not. I think she could take or leave the memes, and you know, her law clerks had to tell her who the notorious B.I.G. was.
So great. But
she's just doing it because she wants to, because it's her mission. She has to fulfill her mission. At the end of the last interview in December, her daughter-in-law Patrice said, you know, ask her, what does she have left that she wants to do? Is there something on her list, or you know, some trip she wants to take? So I said, what's left? What do you want to do? And she almost seemed surprised by the question. She said, well, I just want to keep doing the work for as long as I can do it well. I mean, she's completely focused on just on doing exactly what she's doing. She's on mission, and she's in the flow, and that's what she's going to do.
Yeah. So the subhead of this is Ruth Bader Ginsburg on life, love, liberty, and law. I think it's interesting that law is last there. Love and her relationship with Marty is a big part of this.
It was so inspiring. I mean, it was really daunting for anyone who met them because it was such an amazing love story, and he was a very hard act for any man to live up to. First of all, he was incredibly funny, and he made her just laugh out loud so much. They were in love all the time, and she would look at him with these shining eyes and just crack up. And he would do things like he told his kids that the statue on the top of the Capitol was of him. And then he had this running gag that he was actually more famous than her. So when he walked into the opera and there's a standing ovation, he whispers, "I didn't realize there was a convention of tax lawyers in town." But he also cooked like a dream, and he was the main cook in the spouse's dining room, which is it used to be called at the Supreme Court. He would make the lunches for all the justices and the spouses. He'd cook for the Scalia-Ginsburg New Year's party, where Scalia went every year, and they would sing around the piano. And one year there were two other singers, and Scalia said, "This is the really famous three tenors," and so forth. But mostly, Marty supported Ruth's career, and he cared for the kids. And she said over and over again that the only way men and women will become equal is when men take equal responsibility with women for child care. And he did that.
He did.
He really did. Yeah. So as a result, you can see the all the movies are great, but the one with Arnie Hammer shows his support for her, and the fact that he's coming up with a tax case and he goes into the other room and says, "You've got to take this one on." Incidentally, she loved the movie. It was written by her nephew, and she met Arnie Hammer, who came to visit her at the court, and she thought he was cute.
Nice. Nice. Scalia Ginsburg, the opera.
Yes.
We started with opera. Let's get close to ending with opera. Tell us about that.
Well, it's great. We put on a concert performance for the National Constitution Center here in D.C. a few years ago, and it was done by a law student at the University of Maryland who came up with melodies from all the great operas and set it to a story that I had actually reported in the New Republic when I was a young journalist, and she told us at Justice Scalia's funeral. The story was this, that I had gone to a meeting with the law clerks right before she was nominated, and Scalia had been there a few weeks before, and someone asked Scalia, "If you had to be trapped on a desert island with the two frontrunners for the court seat, who were Lawrence Tribe or Mario Cuomo, who would you choose?" And he shot back, "Ruth Bader Ginsburg." So I reported that story in the piece
so
endorsing
great.
Her. It was so great. So the opera, the setup of the opera is that Scalia and Ginsburg are trapped on a desert island for the rest of their life, and the only way they can escape is by coming up with a common constitutional philosophy. So they do a lot of singing, and she and I have the great pleasure of playing Name That Tune. So she comes into the music of Carmen, and Scalia sings a lot of Puccini. But her favorite aria is the one at the end that says, "We are different, we are one, united by our love of the Constitution and the court." And it's very moving. And that aria, which, you know, seemed uplifting, seems all the more moving now in this unbelievably partisan, polarized Washington. Just, you know, we're sitting here, the impeachment is just over. All of us I've lived here for many decades have never seen Washington so divided. Just that vision of these two people who disagreed fiercely. I mean, she was not happy at all about Bush v. Gore, about a lot of those decisions, but they respected each other. They made each other laugh, and they bonded over music, and they were united by a love of the court and the Constitution.
Nice. Is there anything, okay, this really is the question, like, get you out. Is there anything we don't know about RBG? Or what's the one thing you wish people did know about her?
Well, I've told you the things that I want people most to know, which is her greatness as a personal as well as a professional model. But, I mean, this will be less thrilling to non-opera geeks than I, but now I know.
We have so many of our hundreds of thousands of listeners.
Now I know what her all-time favorite performances of opera ever were. I asked her that. I really wanted to know, and here's what I didn't know. It's like synchronicity. She was at one of the most famous opera performances of the 20th century when Leonard Warren, a great baritone, keeled over of a heart attack right after his great aria in Forza del Destino. It was very dramatic, and she and Marty just happened to be there, and they were at a lot of other great performances as well, and she remembered them with great power and fondness.
Nice. Very nice. Jeff Rosen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
It's really great. It's Conversations with RBG. Ruth Bader Ginsburg on life, love, liberty, and law. And everyone should check out the National Constitution Center, correct?
Yes, please.
Excellent. Okay. So now, keeping rolling right along. So we have deserted islands, too, here. Jeff, we have deserted islands, too. Great. This one is on Black History Month, or as David calls it, month. Yeah, month.
What do Chinese citizens call Chinese food? They call it food. Go get some food tonight. What do you want to get?
All right, we're going to talk about some books. I'm just going to talk about my favorite, Hidden Figures.
Sure.
The great, great book. And I actually read, I've got to remove the word actually from my vocabulary. I read this book before the movie and then went to see the movie, which is also good. But it's the untold story of four African-American women who helped launch our nation into space. And it's Margot Lee Shetterly, who lives not far from here. She's from Virginia, I think. But it's a wonderful book, a wonderful story that should have been told a long time ago. Yes. Michael?
I was thinking about a book that I'd mentioned earlier in this podcast series, and it's a children's book. It was Jabari Jumps.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one. Sure, always good to bring that back.
And based on last night's Oscars, I actually wanted to go back to a book based on the short story for Hair Love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so nice.
I purchased the book here today, and your staff was very helpful in recommending this and talking about last night's Oscars, because I actually thought
it's a great idea.
This was when Karen Rupert Tolliver and Michael Cherry went up to accept the award. I thought their remarks were the most profound that I heard last night, particularly when she says, and I quote, a firm belief that representation matters deeply, especially in cartoons, because that's when we first see our movies and it's how we shape our lives and think about how we see the world. And we showed the animated short to our 2.5-year-old son this afternoon when he was sitting down to lunch. And I told him I was going to pick up the book so we could read it again, because after we finished the cartoon, he goes, again.
Nice.
And sort of in the spirit of just February or month or just books, with both of these, I'm thinking about the role of a father. And in the animated short, I'll start there because that's what this starts. That's the source material. They use words very sparingly. And at first you wonder, why is that the active choice? And it allows you to ponder that for yourself. And I've been thinking about so many of the moments that I've had with the boys, particularly when Walker's been 18 months to now a little more than 2.5, where he's so much of our interaction is just gut reactions. When we're playing with trains and he hands me the one piece that we need, or when I see him down the street and he sees me and runs up to me and I do most of the cooking. So when he gets something to eat and he goes, Dada, cook. And then he looks at me and goes, good. And we, when we're in the bath, we communicate by lifting our eyebrows, and it's sort of a secret code as we see each other. We just lift our eyebrows at each other. And I'm then reminded of, well, I struggle putting the lotion on, getting the clothes on. And in my own small way, I was able to experience in that 7-minute short, well, I don't know what I would do if Liz was out of the house in the hospital. I was dealing with my own struggles, and I so much wanted to help my kid, my little girl, with her hair, and I couldn't. So I'm sort of in the mode of kids' books, but I just thought that was a really powerful
moment
about fatherhood, and I've just been thinking a lot about it.
It was one of the better accepted speeches last night. It really was. Joaquin Phoenix, could just stop. When you start talking about cows, stop.
Cow thing,
stop. I think he was wrong, by the way, about the cow thing. David?
The Souls of Black Folks by W.E.B. Du Bois. That's all you need to know. You want to know how we're dealing with this whole thing in this country? It still works.
Very good. In the store, Lori? I bet it is. Jeff, do you have any? I didn't give you a homework assignment. Do you have any recommendations?
Well, you can't beat Du Bois, and there's a great David Lebering Lewis biography of him also. Mm-hmm. I mean, people should just read deeply into Du Bois, but it's also really important to read Frederick Douglass and his amazing speech on what good is the 4th of July to the black man, where he invokes the Declaration of Independence, and it is this is the 15th anniversary of the 150th anniversary of the 15th Amendment granting African Americans the right to vote. So reading that amazing story, and I think I'll just say, go to the Interactive Constitution and see the early drafts of the 15th Amendment. And it's so striking that of the very earliest draft would have prohibited poll taxes and literacy tests, which were eventually used to disenfranchise African Americans. And that fell out in the debate because there wasn't enough political support. And as a result, Douglass's hope that this would be the king's cure to discrimination was thwarted. And there was the terrible example of redemption, which Henry Louis Gates describes in his excellent new book, which I recommend, about redemption and the backlash to Reconstruction. And then it took, you know, almost a century for the Civil Rights Act. And then for fiction, Invisible Man is really great. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, we talked about that. We might have had a book report on that one. Excellent.
Very well done.
Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you. Fascinating.
Really, get Conversations with RBG. It's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. And listen to it, because I listened to it as well. Two people did a great job. Okay, thanks to Calvert Woodley. Claude, thanks for making everything happen. Lori, thanks for having us. Kate, everybody here at East City, thank you again. When the rain stops, come on out. It's great. Please do follow us, download us wherever you listen to podcasts, review us. Our reviews have been good. We are off next week and then back on the 24th at Loyalty in Silver Spring with Andrea Chombly. Tell us, David, about Andrea.
I don't do her justice. She is the survivor, the widow of a great sports writer, John McNamara, who worked mainly for the Annapolis Capitol. He was one of the six people that was murdered at the Annapolis Capitol in 2018. He had spent the last several years working on a manuscript about the history of high school basketball, mainly in the District of Columbia and the surrounding areas. It was his life's work. It was his passion. And after his death, she kind of picked up the mantle and figured out how to get it finished and get it published. And she enlisted the help of Dave Elfin, who's a very good sports writer in town, a friend of John's. And they kind of figured it out together. And they published his book, and it's done very, very well the last several months. And she has become not only a champion of her late husband, but, you know, a gun rights advocate and trying to get people to make some sense of what is not sensible. And she was a guest of, I believe it was either Steny Hoyer or Ben Cardin, I'm not sure, at the State of the Union speech last week.
Yeah, amazing. I've only spoken to her on the phone, thanks to David. And I'm just, hey, do you have a few minutes to talk? Oh, yeah, I'm going to go testify, but yeah, go ahead. Yeah, so she's wonderful. So February 24th at Loyalty in Silver Spring. Thanks, everybody. And in the meantime, have a happy Valentine's Day. We're out.